The previous two talks were, as has been expressed, motivational. And I think the brethren here very much enjoyed those talks, not only because they were prepared discourses, but they were uttered with feeling, which we appreciate. Now, the subject matter of Brother Tom's talk this afternoon is the wrestlings of Jacob. So with that title, we submit the floor to Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother Frank. Brethren, I can't tell you what a privilege I feel to be up here before you, and I hope I never take for granted the privilege it is to address the brethren. I have to tell you, though, that I have a physical problem when I speak. When I'm nervous, I get hoarse, and I'm very hoarse right now. But I really do feel it a privilege to address you. I bring you the special love and greetings from your brethren in Chicago, especially my wife, Sister Cheryl, and our children. There were handouts for the brethren. If you haven't gotten one, please raise your hand, and there's some more up here if we can pass out. We won't be getting to the handout for a while. I'll have to talk fast in order to get to it. Brethren, I'm sure you all remember the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. It's a story that's interested me for a long time. It's found in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. But angels were not the only beings that Jacob wrestled with. In our discussion today, we're going to spend some time on that story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. But we're really going to start 20 years earlier, when his wrestlings started, and focus in on a life full of wrestling. As you know, wrestling is a sport where one man tries to outmaneuver another man and pin him to the ground. And sometimes it's not the strongest one who wins, but the most clever, the one who knows the most maneuvers and tricks. There are many ways people wrestle in life with one another, and most of them do not involve physical contact at all. They're maneuvering for better jobs or for a better position over someone else. Well, in human maneuvering, Jacob was an expert. 20 years before Jacob wrestled the angel, he had a wrestling match with his father, Isaac. You remember the incident where Jacob tricked his father into giving him the blessing of the firstborn instead of the real firstborn, Esau. That account begins in Genesis, the 27th chapter. We're not going to take time to read it. It's a lengthy context. But I would like to summarize what happened and where Jacob's life went after that. Remember that when Isaac was old, he called Esau into him. And he told his eldest son that he wanted to give him the blessing of the firstborn. And he told him to go out and hunt and prepare him a fine meal. And after the meal, he would give him the blessing. Well, Isaac's wife, you remember, overheard the discussion. And she went to her younger son, Jacob. And she instructed him to go to their flocks and get two kids and bring them in, and she would prepare it in the way that she knew that Isaac enjoyed. And then Jacob would bring the meal in prepared for Isaac, and he would take the blessing of the firstborn instead of Esau. And that deception worked because Isaac was virtually blind. He couldn't see who was before him. There was some further deception because Esau was a very hairy man, and Jacob was not hairy at all. And Rebecca was very clever because she thought that maybe Isaac would suspect something. So she took some goat skins and put them on his hands and on the back of his neck. So in case Isaac would check, he would appear to be Esau. And then Rebecca even dressed Jacob in some of Esau's clothing. So in case Isaac would smell him, he would smell like Esau, because Esau was an outdoorsman. He was a huntsman. So he had the smell of the field in his clothes. And the trick worked after some initial suspicion, because it didn't sound like Esau, but it certainly felt like Esau and it smelled like Esau. Isaac was convinced, and he gave Jacob the blessing of the firstborn. Well, brethren, you can just imagine how Esau felt when he came back from hunting and he brought in his meal, and Isaac had already eaten the meal and he had already given the blessing to someone else. In Genesis 27:34, we're told that Esau cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry. And in talking about Jacob, Esau said, "Is not he rightly named? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he hath taken away my blessing." And in verse 41, we're told that Esau hated Jacob and said in his heart, "The days of mourning of my father are at hand. Then I will slay my brother Jacob." Well, those words were told to Rebekah, and she immediately warned Jacob and directed him to flee to Haran, the home of her brother Laban. And she would send word when the danger was past and he could come home. Well, brethren, what do you think of what Jacob did? His maneuvering certainly was clever, wasn't it? It was cunning. He got what he wanted. He out-wrestled Isaac. He, in fact, even outright lied, because Isaac said, "Are you Esau?" And Jacob said he was. Well, there were two reasons that Jacob and his mother Rebekah probably felt justified for what they did. You remember at the birth of Esau and Jacob, who were twin brothers, the Lord had said to Rebekah that someday the elder would serve the younger. That's found in Genesis 25:23. And one might reason that Rebekah had to do something to make the words of the Lord come true. One of the inherited rights of the firstborn was that he would assume headship of the family. So after the father died, the firstborn would be elevated to the status of the father. So as the household originally served the father, now they would serve the firstborn. Second was, you remember, that Esau had sold his birthright to Jacob for a pot of stew. Now in this deception, Jacob was simply claiming what was his. He had gotten it by purchase. Did Isaac know about that purchase? We don't know. But we do know that he intended to give the blessing to Esau and not to Jacob. Now, brethren, I don't believe that either of these two reasons was justification for the scheme of Rebekah and Jacob. They were wrong for lying and for deceiving Isaac. Though the Mosaic law had not yet been given, the principle against lying, they must have understood, and they knew that they were doing wrong, even though they might have felt that the ends justified what they were doing. If you read this context of Esau when he comes back to Isaac, it's a real pitiable scene, because he pleads with his father and he cries bitterly, and he felt real resentment against Jacob. And you can understand why. Most of us would probably resent him too for taking what was ours. And I wonder how this whole thing affected Esau's relationship with his mother. I would imagine that after this was all done, Rebekah tried to keep the whole thing secret about her involvement, because she didn't want to alienate her oldest son. She didn't want to lose them both. The entire series of events would have consequences for years to come. In fact, this incident would change all of their lives forever. As a result of Esau's rage, Jacob fled to Haran. You remember Haran? It was where Abraham stopped for a time on his way to Canaan. It's where his father died. It's where God told him to leave, to come to the promised land. As it turned out, brethren, Jacob was in Haran for 20 years. Because of Esau's reaction, we're told that Rebekah was afraid that Esau would kill Jacob. She was afraid of losing Jacob as her son. Well, it appears that after he left, Rebekah never saw him again. So she did lose him, in spite of her fears. That's not what she had in mind in all this. And so in the loss of Jacob, she experienced the consequences of the sins that she had committed. And I think that for the rest of her life, she wondered, how is the Lord going to fulfill this promise of the elder serving the younger, seeing that the elder is so much stronger and the young is terrified of the elder? In fact, the younger is even in a different country. How is the Lord going to fulfill that promise? And in Rebekah's reasoning, I think we see a very limited view of how the Lord could have overruled in those circumstances. She saw things through her realm of experience and didn't expand further. Well, Isaac was deceived one more time in the story. At the end of chapter 27, Rebekah comes to him, and she's looking for an excuse to send Jacob away. And she tells him, "Well, you know, the women in Canaan are not desirable. The women back in Haran, where my family comes from, are much better. Jacob needs to find a wife. So let's send him back to find a wife where my family is." Now, her statement about the women in Canaan was probably true, because Esau had married women from Canaan, and none of them were pleased with those women. So her statement was true, but her intent was to deceive. And Isaac innocently accepted her recommendation because it made sense, and so he sent Jacob away. Again, brethren, we ask, was the scheme that Rebekah had come up with and that Jacob had carried out worth it? It's an interesting study in seeing how the Lord deals with the sins in his people. In spite of these actions, we know that Jacob is one of the most favored of all the ancient worthies. He was greatly loved by the Lord, and after this incident, we see the Lord blessing him over and over again. But does the Lord work that way? Does he bless those who lie and deceive? Well, obviously the answer is that the Lord's blessings on Jacob did not mean that he condoned his wrongdoing. As I said, these actions of Jacob had consequences in his life for the rest of his life. Jacob came to pay a high price for what he did. And as we'll see as the story progresses, that's true. But the Lord's blessings on him continued, even while there were consequences for these other sins. In trying to analyze the Lord's providence in Jacob's life, we see that it's often a complicated thing in the way the Lord deals with us. He may be blessing us along certain lines, and yet allowing consequences for the wrongs that we do. One important lesson, brethren, as we look at the Bible and we read stories like this, is to recognize the complete, utter honesty of the characters and the presentation of these characters in the Bible. It reminds us of the story of David and how his dirty laundry was hung out for future generations to read all about. There was no hiding from the sins that David committed and that Jacob committed. The Bible is utterly honest and revealing. These were real people who made mistakes. But we also see in these lessons that when the heart is basically loyal to the Lord, and these people tried to learn from their mistakes, that the Lord could forgive those mistakes, and he could deal with the sins, and he could turn around those people to be lovers of righteousness, lovers of the things that they were presently violating. It really is a study in the wisdom of the Lord in dealing with imperfect man. And the way he deals with those situations is important for us to study and to understand how we can do that in the shortcomings and failings of others, because that's exactly the commission of the church in the kingdom. How do you deal with a basically good person who's doing something wrong? You don't completely turn away. You try to help them with their wrong and help them to grow through that experience. It's a teaching pattern that we all have to learn, because it's something that it will be invaluable to us in the work of the kingdom. We see in stories like this that God can do great things through ordinary people, ordinary imperfect people, if those people are willing to learn and to accept instruction. And there's a lesson there for all of us. If you're not willing to learn, if you're not willing to change, then the Lord has difficulty working with you. If status quo is the way you're going to be for the rest of your life and there's no further change and progress, that's one of the lessons of Jacob. He was willing to learn and to change. And so mistakes were just mistakes and learning experiences, but they weren't the stop in the progress of the individual. Another lesson in this whole story is that as the Lord's people, we should be the greatest lovers of righteousness, that lying and deceiving should never have a part in our lives whatsoever. We should have a deep appreciation for even the way you do things is important, not just the end result. Jacob had a process that he was using that was wrong, even though the end result in his eyes were good. In knowing God's promise for Jacob that the elder would serve the younger, Rebekah should have been willing to let the Lord work it out and not to take matters into her own hands. And that was a convicting piece of truth for me, that I often see problems and situations that I think I have to figure out. And sometimes I think the Lord wants us to try to figure things out, but there are other times that we have to leave them in the Lord's hands, that we don't have to be clever and cunning in all circumstances of life. No action on Rebekah's part probably would have been the right action in the Lord's eyes. Rebekah didn't need to be clever for the Lord's will to be done. If the Lord said something, it would happen, even if she didn't understand the mechanics, if she didn't understand that it could possibly happen in the way she was doing things. And looking at Jacob, what lesson can we learn from his actions? Well, brethren, if I were to ask our children that question, they might say, well, this simply shows that you shouldn't listen to your parents, because here's a case of the mother leading the son into sin. And you know, there would be some truth in that. If our parents, or anyone else for that matter, should steer us wrong, we should put principle first and understand that we are responsible for our own actions, even if there is other influence that are affecting us. The other person might be responsible for affecting us wrongly, but we ultimately are responsible for our own actions. You know, it's interesting to know that Jacob was not a young man here. He was not a young boy who his mother was controlling. Jacob was 77 years old when all this was happening. And there is one thing I appreciated in Jacob here. In the whole story, you never see him blame his mother. My mother made me do it. It was her influence that caused me to sin. He never did that. He seemed to accept responsibility for his own sins, and he loved his mother. The next 20 years of Jacob's life were lived away from his family. But during that 20 years, we see the Lord working with him and blessing him and really bringing him to a different heart condition. And that is really what this story is about, the progress that Jacob made while he was experiencing the consequences of his sin. He kept growing. And so the sins were okay. They were forgivable. They were stepping stones to further growth. Very shortly after leaving for Haran, God gave Jacob the dream of the ladder or the stairway to heaven, you remember, where he saw angels ascending and descending from God. And in that dream, God reiterated to Jacob the Abrahamic promise that in thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. But then in verse 15, Genesis 28, he adds a promise that sometimes we skip over pretty quickly. But to a man who was terrified of his brother, who was running away from home because of that fear, this promise would have meant something. God says, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Brethren, in spite of Jacob's sin, the Lord was still working with him, and he was reassuring him that he was with him. Yes, Jacob had done wrong, and there would be consequences, but he was still beloved of the Lord. The Lord intended to keep his word to Jacob. Not only the Abrahamic promise, but also the promise that the elder would serve the younger, and that he would someday bring him back to his home. At this point, the Lord comforted Jacob with that vision of the stairway to heaven. And we make prophetic application to that very rightly. But in the context of Jacob's life, it was a reassurance that heaven was still open to him, that his sin had not closed off access to God. These angels were ascending and descending to minister to Jacob and his family. In the 29th chapter, we see Jacob continuing his journey, and the first family member he meets in Haran is his cousin, and as it turned out, his future wife, Rachel. His first action is to help her water her flocks. And in Genesis 29:11, we read that Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Now let me ask you, brothers, how many of you kissed your wife the first time you ever met them? Or better yet, how many of you cried when you first saw them? Well, here was a rare case of love at first sight. Now, that kiss probably isn't as forward as we might think. Clark's commentary says that it was a simple and pure method by which the primitive inhabitants of the earth testified their friendship to one another. And we see it happen again when Laban arrives. He kisses Jacob and welcomes him. It was the kiss of a family member. But then you have to ask, why did he cry when he saw Rachel? The reason is not stated. But maybe to Jacob, what his mother Rebekah had said to Isaac really was on his heart. Jacob was getting old, and he was unmarried. In Jacob's mind, his journey may have been not only a flight from Esau, but also to find a wife, as his mother had said. Jacob knew the romantic story of his parents, of how Abraham sent Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac. And you know, brethren, it's very possible this was the very well of water where Eliezer had his camels watered by Rebekah. That's where his parents' love story began. How many times do you think Jacob heard that story of finding a wife for his father? And now here, probably at the same spot, he met this beautiful young woman who to him was a picture of true loveliness. You know, the things that he had just experienced were really stressful and traumatic, hard to deal with. So when he saw Rachel, maybe he felt that there was hope for him. There was still hope that he could be happy in his life. He must have mulled over the promises that God had made to him. But how could a great nation rise out of him? He was an old man and yet unmarried. In Rachel, maybe he saw the potential that God's promises could come true for him. You know, most men don't cry when they see a beautiful woman. So Jacob's tears were probably a release of anxiety and a recognition, yes, the Lord is still caring for me. After about a month of working for Laban, Laban comes to Jacob and he says, you know, you can't keep working for nothing. What wages shall I pay you? And the wages were Jacob's idea. It was Jacob's idea that as his wage, he wanted Rachel to be his wife and that he would work 7 years for Laban for that. Now that seems like a long time to work for a wife. We're told that to Jacob, the 7 years seemed but a few days. Brethren, there's a lesson in perspective. What to you might be a long time, to this man was like a few days. How many men would work 7 years for their wives? Obviously, Jacob cherished the desire of having Rachel as his wife, so much so that time was like nothing. Brother Russell has a really nice thought about this. He says, our love to God and to each other should be such as to cause our life's service to him and to the members of the body of Christ to seem to us even shorter, comparatively, than was Jacob's service for Rachel. If we were nearer perfect in love, a life of service to God in whatever way he might see fit to use us would be to us a pleasant service. Brethren, is that how you see your life of consecration and sacrifice to the Lord or the brethren? Or are you sometimes like me, that you grudge it and that you're tired and you resent something being asked of you? Or do you refuse to give for one reason or another? Brethren, if that's ever the case, even once in a while, then think about Jacob's love for Rachel. And think about how he served joyfully for 7 years just for the prospect of having her as his wife. That spirit of Jacob's enthusiasm is the same attitude that we should have as we serve the Lord and the brethren. You do it for the love that's in your heart, and you don't concern yourself with the cost. Well, you know the story as it continued to unfold. After the 7 years of service, Jacob came to Laban, and he said, pay up. He says, fulfill your obligation, give me Rachel to be my wife. And so Laban prepares a great feast. And at the end of the feast, he takes his daughter, Leah, and not Rachel, and he gives her to Jacob. It wasn't until the next morning, after sleeping with Leah, that Jacob discovered what Laban had done. And I don't know if it was poor lighting conditions or maybe he had a lot of wine at the feast before, but Jacob was shocked the next morning. And he went to Laban, just as you and I would have done, quite irritated. In Genesis 29:25, he says to Laban, what is this that thou hast done unto me? Did not I serve thee for Rachel? Wherefore hast thou beguiled me? Does that word beguile remind you of something that we just considered? Here was Jacob, the beguiler of Isaac, being himself beguiled. You know, brethren, I wonder if Jacob ever realized the irony of what happened to him. Just as Isaac could not see who he was really giving the blessing to, so Jacob didn't see that it was really Leah and not Rachel that he spent that first night with. Another irony was in the words of Laban when he tried to explain why he did that. In the next verse, Genesis 29:26, Laban says, it must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. There's that firstborn issue again. Here it was used against Jacob. He had to marry the firstborn before he could have Rachel. And I suspect at this point this idea of being the firstborn was getting a little old to Jacob. It had brought him nothing but heartache thus far. And so another deal was struck. And Jacob agreed to serve another 7 years for Rachel. Was Rachel worth 14 years of service? Jacob certainly thought so. There was never any hesitation on Jacob's part to serve 7 more years. And you know, brethren, that just reinforces that lesson that Brother Russell made. When serving the Lord and the brethren, don't ever hesitate to go the extra mile, to serve the extra 7 years. to give more than the minimum requirement in life. Learn the lesson of how important it is to give more deeply of yourself, to serve longer, to work harder, to be really tired in the Lord's service and for the brethren, just as Jacob was willing to serve 14 years for Rachel. He would have done anything because his love for Rachel was so strong. In Genesis 29:27, Laban and Jacob are discussing the matter, and Laban says, "Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me." Well, apparently the marriage festival which they were presently observing was a seven-day feast. So Laban was really saying that if Jacob completed that week of festival without making any big disturbance, without upsetting everything, then he would also give him Rachel. And then after giving him Rachel, then Jacob's 7 years of additional service would begin. So Jacob really married Rachel after 7 years and 7 days. And I guess that made it a little easier to take than waiting the 14 years for Rachel. But you know, it was still fraud on Laban's part. And again, brethren, here is the lesson that what you sow, you will reap. Jacob sowed deceit with Isaac, and here he was reaping deceit with Laban. You know, in the story, one person we don't usually talk about is Leah. How do you think Leah felt in this whole experience? How would you feel if you were Leah and you know that Jacob didn't love you like he loved your younger sister, that he didn't really want you as his wife, that he would not have worked all those years for you? How would you felt if your father had to deceive a man in order to get him to marry you? And then what atmosphere would fill your home when your younger sister, the desired one, became the wife of the man that you had just married 7 days earlier? Things were not easy for Leah. And you know, brethren, as you see the story develop, she did not make them easier for herself either. The Lord recognized her problem in Genesis 29:31. It says, "Jehovah saw that Leah was hated," or loved less, "and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." And here we see the Lord trying to balance the relationship a little bit by allowing Leah to have children and not Rachel for a while. In fact, Leah went on to have 7 children until finally Rachel gave birth to Joseph. Jacob also had 4 children by Leah and Rachel's handmaidens. So, brethren, before Rachel even had 1 child, there were already 11 children born to Jacob. In spite of having 7 children by Jacob, the situation for Leah never was comfortable. And you can understand why. You know, she was jealous, and she had this great sense of rivalry for all the years that she lived with Rachel. How sad that she couldn't even feel secure in her own home, in her own family. You can see the competition that Leah felt, even in the names that she chose for her children. If you look at the handouts that we gave you on the one side, you'll see a chart showing Jacob's children and which women bore which children and the names that were given to them. Now, we're told that Leah's firstborn was named Reuben, and his name means "see a son." Now, that sounds innocent enough, but as you watch the scene unfold, you see that Leah is trying to establish herself as the prominent wife, the successful childbearer, the one responsible for the continuation of the name of Jacob. The name Reuben really was her claim that she was making to be the proper and first wife of Jacob. Leah wanted to be remembered that her firstborn was a child, was a son, almost as if stating, "I'm the better wife. I bore Jacob a son." But Leah then bore Simeon, which means hearing. In Genesis 29:33, she explains that she chose his name, why she chose his name. She says, "Because the Lord has heard that I was hated." Again, we see it connected to her family struggle for Jacob's affection. And then comes Levi, which means joined. In verse 34, she says, "Because now my husband will be joined with me." And then Leah bears Judah, which means praise. And her reason in verse 35 is that now I will praise the Lord. And brethren, if we're catching the spirit of Leah correctly, the reason she praises him was because now with one more son, she thought that surely she could win Jacob's affection. You see, she was still very insecure. It was still clear that in spite of bearing 4 sons to Jacob, Jacob still loved Rachel more than he loved her. And all this maneuvering, all this boasting on Leah's part did not sit well with Rachel. At one point during all this names and claims that Leah was making, in Genesis 30, verse 1, we see Rachel finally reacting. It says that when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." She was so frustrated by all this that she finally tells Jacob to take her handmaiden Bilhah and have children by her. Bilhah then had Dan and Naphtali. The name Dan means judging. And Rachel explains in Genesis 36 that now God has judged me and heard my voice. She tried to consider Dan as if he were her own son, and that now she was no longer barren because her handmaiden had borne children. At the birth of Naphtali, Rachel says in Genesis 30, verse 8, "With great wrestlings have I wrestled my sister and have prevailed." And she calls his name Naphtali, which means wrestling. So wrestling was not only Jacob's domain. His wives learned how to wrestle amongst themselves. Rachel now thought that she had prevailed over Leah because her handmaiden had now borne Jacob two sons. Well, the story continues. Not to be outdone by Rachel, Leah then gives her handmaiden to Jacob because she thought she was now no longer able to bear children. From Zilpah, which was Leah's handmaiden, Gad and Asher were born. Gad means a troop. It's almost a name given as a rebuttal. "I've borne a troop of sons to Jacob in comparison to you." The name Asher means happy. And in verse 13, she says, "Happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed." Again, blessed because she brought forth so many sons. Blessed above Rachel. Brethren, we're going to skip the other names in Leah's column because of time. But they tell the same story of competition between these two women. In Genesis 30:24, we finally see that Rachel bears a child, and she calls him Joseph. She says that now with his birth, God had finally taken away her reproach. The name Joseph means adding. And the reason she chose it was because she felt that now her barrenness was over. Now God would add children unto her. And God did. He added one more. A few years later, after Jacob had returned to Canaan with his family in a very difficult labor, Rachel bore her second son, whom she named Benoni, which means son of my affliction, a reference to her difficult childbirth. Rachel died in giving birth to Benoni. And shortly afterwards, Jacob changed the child's name to Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. And what he meant by that was, "This son is especially dear and precious to me." In the birth of Benjamin, Jacob had his last connection with his beloved Rachel. So, brethren, it was quite a household brought forth here, wasn't it? The roots of the nation of Israel came from Leah's desire to win Jacob's affection and acceptance, and Rachel's desire to bring forth sons and be equal with her sister. The difficulty that these family members created amongst themselves was just quite remarkable. From strictly a human standpoint, brethren, and this is strictly as a human, not as a Christian or anything, from a human standpoint, I would not have wanted to be in that family, in that environment of competition and jealousy. It was just a strifeful situation for that family. Certainly when the mothers were so much at odds with one another, the children could not fail to pick up that spirit amongst themselves. And we see that in the children. You remember the story of the life of Joseph. Remember how his older brothers resented the dreams of how they would someday bow down to him, and as a result of that jealousy, they wanted to murder him, but they compromised and sold him into slavery. Brethren, a well-balanced home environment is so important. Our home should be a place totally devoid of jealousy or strife or resentment or competition in any way. You and I both know we have enough enemies out there. We do not need them in our own homes. And brethren, if there is anything like this in any of your homes, if there is any division between you and your spouse, or you and your children, or you and any family member, don't accept that as the way life is, because that's what Leah and Rachel did. They accepted that, and they were miserable for it, and the Lord was not pleased for it. So if anything like that exists in your life, in your family, do something about it. Change it. Pray to the Lord. Leah and Rachel could have risen above all of that. But they certainly would have needed the Lord's help. They would have needed Jacob's help and cooperation. And they would have needed a deeper love for one another. You've heard that phrase that happiness is a choice. And in large measure, that's true. We can make the choice of being content with our life, lot in life. We can make the choice of encouraging love and good feelings and good things. But in a family, it's a little different. Happiness and peace and cooperation only works if that choice is made by each family member. Rachel could not have healed the family rift without Leah being part of the solution. So it takes more than one to heal problems within a family. Brethren, in this story, I can't help thinking about how the Lord can work his plan through people who had problems and who were not always so good. And you know, that's encouraging to me. It tells me I can have problems and the Lord can still work through that. He can still deal with it. He can still heal. God had a predetermined plan to establish Israel as a nation. And in spite of the battles between Leah and Rachel and their 13 children and the things that Jacob did wrong, God accomplished that purpose. But again, that doesn't mean that there were not consequences to this family. Because wherever there is evil, wherever there is wrongdoing, wherever there is even a wrong spirit, there are negative consequences. Even if the Lord is dealing with those individuals and blessing them along other lines, we want to be complete. We want to be whole in all the aspects of our life. Don't let one area of your life slip because you see the Lord blessing you somewhere else. Have a whole, complete picture of your life, as Jacob should have done. Jacob was greatly blessed by the Lord, but it took years for that to become clear. He had left Canaan all alone, broke, fleeing for his life, and terrified of his brother. He returned to Canaan many years later with great wealth and a large family. The Lord blessed Jacob for his father's sake and also for the good that was in Jacob's own heart. But as I said, there was still a price that Jacob paid for the wrong that he did. His home life was not peaceful. His family was not united in the strong bonds of love that it could have been. Well, in Jacob, in Genesis 30, verse 25, Jacob had finished his 14 years of service and he came to Laban and he wanted to take his family back to Canaan. Laban knew that if Jacob left, it would not be in Laban's best interest because Jacob was pretty sharp. In verse 27 and 28, Laban says, "I pray thee, if now I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake." And he said, "Appoint me thy wages, and I will give it." Well, Jacob had prospered, as I said, as a servant of Laban. And now Laban convinced him to stay for six more years, and that's where we get our 20 years of his time in Haran. Laban had always seemed to be trying to take advantage of Jacob. But in the end, it was Laban who was taken advantage of as Jacob's flock prospered and Laban's began to grow weaker. In Genesis 31, verses 1 through 3, it says, "Then he heard the words of Laban's son," this is Jacob, "saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's hath he gotten all this glory. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not towards him as before. And Jehovah said unto Jacob, Return unto thy land of thy father's, and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee." Well, finally, brethren, after 20 years in a foreign land, Jacob was ready to return to Canaan and confront his brother. It was a long time to run away from his problems, but that time was not wasted. The Lord had been working with him, and he was gradually teaching him to be more dependent on God rather than on his own wit. You know, brethren, this really shows us how the Lord can use our mistakes and work through us and help work through them and help us grow, as I said before. But how long that growth takes really depends on each of us. Sometimes it might take 20 years or more to learn how to be heart-reliant on the Lord. And that's what Jacob was learning while he was away from home. When Jacob left Haran, we're told that he left secretly because he knew that Laban would be upset. And there was one last encounter between Laban as he pursued Jacob, but the Lord warned Laban not to hurt Jacob, and so the final parting was amicable between them. On his journey to Canaan, Jacob sent word ahead to Esau that he was returning, and word came back that Esau was coming out to meet him with 400 men. not exactly clear what Esau's intentions were, but because there were so many men with him, that it seemed to imply that he was still angry with Jacob and possibly still wanted to kill him after 20 years. When Jacob was told about Esau's band, he was terrified. And in verse 9 of Genesis 32, we're told that Jacob falls on his knees in prayer. Brethren, this is a major turning point for Jacob, a man who always figured things out for himself. Now he was afraid, and the first thing he does is fall on his knees. In the previous story that we read, never once did he fall on his knees when he was confronted with a major problem like this. He always tried to figure it out for himself. But finally, the first thing he does when he's in danger is go to the Lord in prayer. I think that shows tremendous growth and progress on Jacob's part. Jacob was determined that he wasn't going to fight his brother. And the next morning, he sends gifts to Esau. He sent over 500 various types of animals from his flock to appease Esau's anger. Later that night, he took his family and passed over the brook Jabbok, which is a river that flows into the Jordan about halfway between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And this was Jacob's official re-entering into Canaan. He sent the others ahead, and he remained one more night. We're not sure why he stayed by himself, but we know what happened when he did, because this is where we come to the famous story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. Let's read the account beginning in Genesis 32, verse 24. It says, "And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was strained as he wrestled with him. And he said, Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." Brethren, this is really an unusual story. I was trying to think of an analogy of how to describe this battle between an angel and a fallen human being. And the only analogy I can come up with was an ant trying to wrestle an elephant. And the ant thinking, I can do it, I can do it. As long as I keep fighting, maybe I'll win. And the elephant trying to be careful so he doesn't, you know, destroy the ant, holding back. Why did the Lord do this? Had he not promised on a number of occasions that he would bless Jacob? Had he not promised that he would be with him wherever he went? Why did God send an angel to wrestle him? Well, there have been a number of suggestions about what actually went on, but there's really not enough information provided for us to know things like, well, what did the angel look like? Did Jacob first think he was an ordinary man who was just there to block his way? Who was this stranger? Let me read a short quote from a treatment on this subject by Brother Donald Holliday. I like his reasoning. This appeals to me. He says, "Jacob begins the struggle, believing he is wrestling with a human foe who attacks him. He schemes with man's thoughts and endeavor to outdo his human opponent, but sooner or later in the struggles he recognizes in himself the chief opponent, for he comes to realize that he is fighting with God." Well, in the story we're told that they wrestled all night, and in the morning the angel touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and put it out of joint. Now, to me that sounds like the angel possibly disjointed Jacob's hip. Those of you who have had hip problems know the kind of pain that might be involved with that. I believe it was excruciating for Jacob. But in spite of the tremendous pain, we're told that Jacob would not let go but insisted on receiving his blessings. And the angel relented and blessed Jacob. And this is what the angel said in verse 27. He says, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for thou hast striven with God and with men and hast prevailed." Didn't the angel know what his name was? Why did he have to ask? Well, obviously, brethren, the angel was trying to make a point to Jacob. He wanted Jacob to recognize that he was no longer to be like his namesake, the supplanter, the cunning, the crafty one, the one who used his own devious, clever ways to get what he wanted. From now on, he would be called Israel, which means God prevails. From now on, Jacob would recognize that the only way to defeat his enemies was to submit himself to God and let God prevail. He was no longer to be a wrestler of men. We see how God prevailed later in Jacob's life in the story of Joseph. Had not God overruled behind the scenes and brought Joseph to power in Egypt in a very unusual way, Jacob and his entire family may have died in the great famine that was there. You know, brethren, there was nothing that his cunning or deception could have done to avoid that famine. But in the Lord's strength, it was like an unbelievable miracle of deliverance was performed in Egypt through the son of Rachel, and out of it, the nation of Israel was born. God prevailed in that experience. Jacob didn't have to use his own cunning and craftiness. Brethren, there is a universal lesson being taught here. It belongs not only to Jacob, not only to us, the church, but it's a lesson for all mankind. It's the lesson of the permission of evil. Through our first parents in the Garden of Eden, mankind thought they knew a better way. They could be cunning and clever and find a way to be like gods. They were willing to listen to outside influences and not trust in the Lord's wisdom and guidance. They wrestled with the notion of becoming great without God's help. Like Jacob, this whole experience has been a painful lesson of exile and servitude to sin. But like Jacob again, when the world humbles itself and seeks the Lord, and all the struggles of the world are in the right directions, in the way the Lord would want them to struggle, then God will bless them as he blessed Jacob. The disjointing of Jacob's hip seems like it had harmed some tendons in that area, and it's believed by many that Jacob walked with a limp for the rest of his life. Brethren, that limp was a blessed reminder of this great truth, that Jacob could not walk alone in his life without the Lord's help. He needed the Lord to prevail in all his struggles of life. Jacob, I don't think, ever forgot that lesson for the rest of his life, and maybe that limp was his reminder that he should always rely on the Lord. Brethren, there's a personal application to this scene of Jacob wrestling with the angel. You know, the Lord has made many wonderful promises to each of us. He's promised never to leave us alone. He's promised not to allow any trial harder than we can bear. He's promised to bless us and to use us in his service. But there are times in our lives when those things just don't seem to be happening. What the Lord appreciated in Jacob was that he persevered in his pursuit for the Lord's blessings. This is what Brother Russell says about that aspect of Jacob on reprint 3970. And this really is a gem thought from Brother Russell. He says, "We are to understand that it was God's good pleasure to give the blessing. He had already intimated this. But that the blessing might be valuable to Jacob, it was withheld for a time until he would more and more feel his need of it and cry out and struggle to obtain it, that when obtained, it might be the more highly esteemed and affect thereby the greater influence upon his heart and faith and future course. And so it is with our prayers." Brethren, sometimes when the Lord appears to be withholding his blessing, he's trying to give us a deeper appreciation for the value and the beauty of his favor in our lives. I think maybe you're like me. It's so easy to lose sight of that and to take his favor and blessing for granted. So when the Lord's blessings seem to delay, brethren, keep struggling in all the right directions, and it will invariably come. He's promised it. What happens in the next chapter of Jacob's life is really touching. After this memorable night of wrestling with God's angel, we see Esau and his 400 men approaching. As Jacob approaches Esau, Jacob, we're told, bows himself to the ground 7 times. In Genesis 33:4, we read, "And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." Well, it seems to have been Jacob's humbling of himself before his brother that really touched Esau's heart so deeply. The humility of Jacob created compassion in Esau's heart, and the two brothers finally came together and blessed one another. And finally, after all those years, they were reunited, and they really felt a sense of love for one another. Esau expressed a wonder at what Jacob might have meant by setting all those animals on ahead. He hadn't really caught the drift of why Jacob was doing that. And Jacob explained it was to find favor in Esau's eyes. Look at Esau's reply in verse 9. He says, "I have enough, my brother. Let that which thou hast be thine." But Jacob insisted, and he says, "Take my blessing, because God has dealt graciously with me." Brethren, that is such a beautiful spirit on both of their parts. And it's so different than the selfish spirit that we saw when they were together the last time. Jacob, in a sense, was now giving back the blessing that he stole 20 years earlier. And the funny thing is, Esau didn't want it. He wanted Jacob to keep it. And that thrilled me, the spirit that they both displayed and how different it was than before. Jacob was now home. He had made peace with his brother. But the battles for Jacob were not over yet. He goes on and he has to deal with the many sins of his children. In the 34th chapter, he has to deal with the sins of Simeon and Levi. You remember when they murdered all the men of Shechem after their sister had been defiled by one of them. In the 35th chapter, the Lord instructs Jacob to return to Bethel. We had seen the vision of that stairway to heaven and there build an altar. And we're told that the purpose of returning to Bethel was to purify his family and have them put away their idols. So apparently there was idolatry in Jacob's family still at this point. Well, Jacob's family was in danger as they journeyed to Bethel because of what Simeon and Levi had done. But in Genesis 35:5, we're told that as they journeyed to Bethel, they were protected from the people of the land because in some way the Lord had put a fear into their heart. Then God reiterates Jacob's name change, and he repeats the Abrahamic promise. After setting up an altar, Jacob and his family leave Bethel, and on the way home, Rachel delivers Benjamin, and she dies in childbirth. Friend, this is where we're going to end the story of Jacob. We can keep going. There's so many fascinating details in his life. But again, I was impressed at how the Lord took a man like Jacob and was able to make a great nation out of him. In spite of his mistakes and shortcomings, the Lord developed his character and led him away from his natural propensity to wrestle himself to the top of the world. Jacob learned how to let the Lord prevail in his life. And this was his legacy and his example, and I think the reason he was chosen as the father of Israel and the reason this story is given to us. Brethren, that should be the church's legacy as well. Who prevails in your battle? Do you have to figure everything out, or do you go to the Lord and say, Lord, help me. Prevail for me. Show me your solution. What should I do? What is your will for me? Some of us have the tendency to want to figure it all out for ourselves, and we don't have to do that. In fact, it is a mistake to do that. Well, it's always interesting to look for some prophetic application to such detailed stories like this. And the application that we usually make when discussing Jacob and Esau is that Jacob represented the true church and Esau represented the false church who, like Esau, sold his birthright. And that picture is expressed a number of times in the scriptures, and it's a good picture. But there's another one I'd like to examine for just a moment. It's a picture that you can read about on the New Bible Student Library CD. It's an article from a brother I quoted earlier, Brother Donald Holliday, and it's entitled Jacob at Jabbok. And I tried to illustrate the application that he's making in his article. Brethren, take this for what it's worth. I found it very interesting, the application, because it seems to be a confirmation of God's plan in the lives of these four men. He says that, taken together, we're just going to review your chart real quickly, taken together the lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph illustrate various parts of God's plan. Their names are listed across the bottom of the chart to show the general areas that their lives represent. The two ages before Jesus are pictured by Abraham's walk of faith before the birth of Isaac. The first dispensation might correspond to Abraham's call to leave Babylon until Terah's death, when he took his first direct steps to the promised land. As you see on the chart, the first two ages were a time of looking forward by faith to the promised seed. In the first dispensation, the promises of deliverance from the Adamic curse and the hopes for future blessings were vague and were still relatively unclear. That corresponds to the earlier life of Abraham before he actually left Babylon. The Lord had appeared to him and promised that if he obeyed and went to Canaan, that then he would make him a promise that he would bless all the nations of the earth. After the death of his father Terah, Abraham finally came to Canaan, and the promise was officially given by God that he would bless him, and that through him and his seed, all the families of the earth would be blessed. Dwelling in Canaan corresponds then to the Jewish age, when the seed of Abraham became distinct and separated. It was also a time when the promises of future blessings became more clear, with more definitive hopes regarding Messiah. We see this in the fact that the law more clearly explained the work of Messiah than was known before the law was given. The types and the shadows of the law were given primarily to illustrate the coming Messiah and his work of redemption and blessing of the world. When in the land of promise, we know that Abraham did not yet claim it for himself. So the promises to Israel could not yet be fulfilled. They could not be claimed by Israel because the Messiah had not yet come. Finally, after years of waiting, Isaac was born, symbolic of the birth of the true Messiah. The offering of Isaac clearly represents the actual death of our Lord. And when God provided a ram to take the place of Isaac, we see an illustration of the resurrection of Jesus. A ram, you remember, was used in the tabernacle to show the acceptance of the previous sacrifice. Jesus' resurrection was proof that his previous life of sacrifice had been acceptable to God. This brings us to the end of the Jewish age, where the symbolic sacrifices of the law were no longer appropriate. Now a new and living way was opened up, and the call for a bride had begun. This was illustrated when Eliezer was sent out to search for a bride for Isaac. And here's where our picture overlaps a little bit. Besides searching for a spiritual bride, it was also a time of forced servitude for natural Israel in their double of disfavor. And this, we think, is illustrated by Jacob's exile from Canaan for 20 years of servitude to Laban. As Esau remained in Canaan, so for much of the time the borders of Israel were occupied by the Arabs, while Israel was dispersed in other lands. As God gave Jacob a vision of the stairway to heaven as an encouragement to his faith, so Israel had the promises that through them all the families of the earth would be blessed, and that was to encourage and strengthen them. In that vision of Jacob's ladder, there was also the promise that someday God would bring Jacob back to his homeland. This corresponds quite simply to the Lord's promises that he would regather Israel from the four corners of the earth, from whithersoever he has driven them. To Jews everywhere, the promise that they would someday return to their homeland was really a powerful message. It was a message that helped sustain them through the ordeal and the persecutions of the diaspora. Their rallying cry, you remember, was next year in Jerusalem. In spite of Jacob's servitude to Laban, we see that he prospered, even to the point where Laban's sons hated him for it and accused him of taking away everything that belonged to their father. Jacob had used his intelligence and cunning to gain wealth for himself. But even in that, Laban prospered from the intelligence and cunning of Jacob. These accusations of Laban's sons might illustrate the Gentiles' propensity to blame the Jews for everything, for every wrong. And we see that all down through the age, but we see it intensely magnified in Nazism, when Jews were blamed for economic problems, social problems, for every ill of society. It was the Jews' fault, just as Laban's sons blamed Jacob. In the story of Jacob, Laban was not permitted to harm Jacob, you remember. And so all the enemies of Israel, though permitted to persecute Israel, were never permitted to destroy Israel. It's a wonderful example of how God can use the wrath of man to praise him. Boy, if there's any other example than Israel of how God can use evil intentions to accomplish something good, it's Israel. Shortly before Jacob returned to Canaan, his first son through Rachel was born. The birth of Joseph was a much more precious thing to Jacob than the birth of his other sons. And the reason was that, obviously, Rachel was the more favored, just as the grace covenant is more favored than the law covenant. In this picture, brethren, the birth of Joseph, we think, might correspond to the Lord's return in 1874. Because in Joseph's life, we see a beautiful picture of the work of the kingdom. Joseph's future mission, after being raised to great power in Egypt, would be to deliver his brethren from the famine in the land. It was really a picture of the work of the glorified Christ and the work of blessing and saving mankind. That scene of Jacob wrestling with the angel very well might correspond to natural Israel's restoration to the land. It was when Jacob wrestled with the angel that his name was changed to Israel, the first step in transforming a family into a nation.